Hey, it's Molly Webster. I have a surprise for you. Next month, myself and producer Mona Medgaukar are going to do an AMA about our snail sex tape episode. You can ask us anything about snails and the behind the scenes of making an episode work. How long did it take us to make? How did we come up with the sound effects? Why are snails and slugs related? The AMA will be on April 16th, and in order to come, you have to be a member of the lab. So go to radiolab.org/join right now, sign up, use the code word snail to get a discount on your membership. And also, if you sign up now, you get a snail enamel pin. If you're already a member of the lab, come to the AMA. Thank you for listening. Can't wait to see you there, April 16th.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Oh, okay. All right. You're listening to Radio Lab on New York Public Radio, WNYC. Now? Okay. You're listening to Radio
Lab. On New York Public Radio.
Public Radio, WNYC.
On New York
Public Radio. Public Radio, WNYC.
Keep listening. Okay.
Okay, so the other day I should we say who we are?
Yeah, I guess we should.
Okay, Jad.
Robert.
Radio Lab. Okay, so the other day Soren called us into the studio.
There they are.
Oh.
And there was a giant human-sized rodent sitting in the engineering seat.
Very large rodent that was very familiar to us because it was a puppet head that we had toured with.
Who is that under that big Schrodinger?
Well, that's
costume?
The question. That is the question. Maybe you guys should guess or something.
Oh, my goodness. Is it...
Is this Ellen?
Oh, my God.
It is. Oh, my God.
Hi.
Happy birthday, Radio Lab.
All right, so the story is, the reason that Soren got Ellen to surprise us is that somewhere around now is the 15-year, crazy to say it, 15-year anniversary of making Radiolab.
15 years?
I know.
We have some tape for you guys.
Oh, there's more?
We brought you
besides just your presence?
Well, it just seemed like you ought to have someone around who knew you when, you know?
Okay.
I brought your presence with my presence.
So we sort of settled in. We didn't really know what was going on. And then Horn did something truly evil. She somehow, I don't know how, probably the archivist's help, got her hands on the very first one.
No! This is my nightmare.
The very, very, very...
I had hoped these tapes would never surface, but she found them. They were on BitTorrent for a second, and I thought they had disappeared, and I was, like, so happy, but then...
Wait, roll tape.
So
roll tape.
You want to review it? You ready?
So good. It's
okay,
so good.
Let me roll tape. All right, here we go.
It's 2002, very first one. Oh, God, don't start talking. Please make the CD crash right now. Every radio producer has this idealized image in their head of you.
Oh, God.
Maybe you're sitting on the couch, drinking coffee, staring out the window. Maybe you're the person who's driving and you pull over to really concentrate on a story. Whatever the case, that image in the radio producer's brain of you, the listener, that's why they make this stuff. It's a lonely thing. You know, they don't get paid much. They lug around these heavy recorders and mics, and they look, frankly, silly in those headphones they have to wear. But it doesn't matter, as long as you are there to listen to what they make. WNYC is about to embark on an experiment. We're calling it the Radio Lab. And
I love that, the Radio Lab.
What we're going to do is take great documentary radio and stories of different sizes and shapes, colors, from different places all over the planet, from different times even, and we're going to mix it all together, like this.
Whoa!
A big brew of people and places, but it'll take 2 hours and 59 minutes to get through all of it.
2 hours and 59
minutes.
Do you hear that?
2 hours.
It's a three-hour show.
It was a three-hour show.
And was that every week, by the way?
Every freaking week.
Every week.
8 to 11 every Sunday night.
So they were giving you a huge hunk of airtime.
A huge hunk of airtime where no one was listening. Jad Abumrad here. I'll be your, host is not the right word, curator, guide maybe. How about DJ of documentary?
Oh, yeah. Shut up.
Really? So that's terrible. That doesn't work at all.
All right, I'll stop it. I'll...
Every moment of that was wrong. Every moment.
Oh. I have to explain, like, the show was just super different back then. The idea of it back then was to just take all of these documentaries from around the world and smash them together. But what would end up happening is that, like, I would line up three or four things and I would have like a 20-minute hole, which I would start to experiment in. And that's, those spots were what the show grew out of.
Well, so that was in 2002. And then I met you the following spring. And
wow,
then
a whole year later.
A whole year later.
And so there's a year worth of that.
And by the time I met you back in New York, you were so sleep deprived.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we reminisced for a little bit. And then we started talking about the moment when Robert got involved, which is a moment I'll never forget. So, you know, I was trying to fill one of those 20-minute holes. I had done an interview with a memory researcher, and it was just one of those science interviews that now we're super familiar with, where like the scientist is using all this Latinate words, and I couldn't figure out what she was saying, but it still seemed interesting. I just couldn't understand it. And so Robert and Ellen and I had breakfast one day at Kitchenette.
It was our foundation restaurant. That's what we go to for breakfast every week.
And we were sitting there, and I was like, I got this interview. I don't really know what to do. It's about memory. And here's what I think she's saying. I think she's saying something about how memories are never the same. You're always constantly remaking them. And then you just like snapped into this thing where like suddenly you were playing this like all these characters. And Elle and I were like, oh my God, let's just go into the studio and have him do that.
You want to hear a little taste of the time?
I'm sort of curious.
Wait, this is one. Just
so this
one
is
off?
Like, we later did the memory and forgetting as a podcast, but this is this is before that. It's a different, earlier.
2003, yeah. I think.
You're listening to Radio Lab. On New York Public Radio.
Public Radio WNYC.
I'm Jad Abumrad. This is Radio Lab. We're coming up on the Kitty Hawk Centennial, the 100th anniversary of the first human-powered flight. It's in a couple of weeks. And I was looking at the picture today. No, you weren't. The Wright brothers, you know the one. Orville's on the plane. It's just taking off. Wilbur is running alongside. They're on a beach. The beach is deserted. It looks really, really cold. And I'm looking at this photo.
Really?
And even though it is the most published picture in the history of pictures.
Where did that come from?
Even though anyone who's ever been born has seen it 100,000 times, I couldn't help but be wowed. I mean, look at what they did. They got that crazy box into the air. A couple hundred feet, or whatever it was. It wasn't that great a distance, but look at us now. We can fly over the Atlantic in 5 hours. A few $100. And that is not what we're going to talk about today. Because my real question is, how is it we can do all that and still not understand some very basic things like common cold? That's the example that's always given. And what about memory?
What about memory? Is that what you said?
That was
sweet about
it. That was such a good intro.
What about memory?
That was a minute 30.
Wow.
That's a strange.
Sort of like, well, here's a pogo stick. I'm going to jump on it 50 times. But what about tissues?
That's such a random way to get in. Do I eventually talk about Kitty Hawk, or was that just utterly random?
No. But let's go a little bit further forward so we get to hear Robert enter the room.
It involves creativity.
This clip actually begins with a reading from theater director and actor Simon McBurney.
You have to literally remake it every time. Every memory that you remember is different because it is remade in the very present that you remember. In other words, in order to remember, you need the imagination.
Simon McBurney, performing a monologue from his play Mnemonic for the show Studio 360. And with me in the studio to explore these ideas a little further is Mr. Robert Krowich from ABC News.
Hi, Robert.
Hi.
You've reported on this, right?
Yeah, I have. I never actually met Simon McBurney, but that thought that he has at the very end, that in order to remember something, you need an active imagination. I think that's kind of understating it, really, I think.
Understating it? How so?
Well, let's just take the situation we're in right now.
Okay.
I'm sitting here in front of you. We're about, 3 feet apart or something like that?
Yeah.
So when you look at me right now, it takes actually the light that's bouncing off my face a tiny bit of time to reach your retina. But by the way, I arrive upside down, and to have your brain write me, it takes a little bit of time for the sound of me, this sound, right now, you think, haha, but the sound has to travel at 750 miles an hour from me to you.
Okay.
Then it has to enter that ear that you have. It has to travel through those hairs that you've got in your ear. It has to turn into electricity. And it has to go to the place in your brain where sounds lie. And then the touch of me, if I were to touch you right now, would have to travel electrically to your brain. That would take a little time.
Got it.
And the smell, let's suppose I put some licorice in my mouth. I go, the smell of the licorice coming out of my mouth, that too would have to travel all the way to your nose, up your nose, into the place where smells lie. And then your brain has to take all these parts and pull them together into this thing that you think is going on right now.
Wait, let me get this straight. You're saying that this moment.
Yes.
And this one.
Yes.
Are hopelessly lost. So when people say, you know, you have to live in the moment. This isn't the moment.
The moment already just happened. Just happened. Or, to put it another way, it's a memory. Everything is a memory.
Wow. So let's say we want to ponder this moment. This one that you say has already happened before it had a chance to become this moment. But let's say we want to remember it later. What do we do?
It's interesting at this moment. What's going to happen is you're going to take the touch, the sound, the smell, and everything that's in your brain from that moment, which is all sitting lodged in different places, and you're going to reassemble it, pull it back together again. Now, here's the interesting thing. If 20 minutes from now you are really hungry, then the licorice, remember the licorice part of our discussion?
Yep.
The licorice part will somehow loom a little larger because you want to eat or chew something.
Oh.
How you're feeling in the moment that you're remembering has a lot to do with what you remember. So for example, let's just take a simple phrase like Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
Right.
If you want to recollect that phrase, let's suppose you just had a wonderful thing with Jill. Now, when you think of the rhyme, when you reassemble it, Jack and Jill went up the hill. It'll go, Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
Wait.
See, the Jill thing is so there for you.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Or suppose that instead you've just come from an extraordinary hike where you have gloriously climbed a spectacular hill. So now you hear the thing, and when you reassemble it this time, you think Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
I see, hill.
Now the hillness has got all the emphasis.
Yeah, I got it.
So you're always remembering differently each time up, depending upon how you feel.
This reminds me of something. Here, let me play you this interview clip.
Every time you recall something, you're doing so with
the... I mean, it's amazing to me that at such an early point, the business of deconstructing puzzles, which I guess is a lot of what we did, it took on this very particular quality, like this kind of razzle-dazzle of anything could happen in the next second. I don't know who's going to say the next thing, but there's something beautifully organic about it when it's done.
Yeah. So today we're celebrating 15 years of making Radiolab. Coming up after the break, we're going to play the first thing we ever podcasted. It's not something you can get on iTunes because it fell off iTunes a long time ago, but we're going to play you the first.
This is Lisa Kenny calling from San Diego. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Guys, it's tax season. Are you as stoked as I am? No, of course you aren't. Because taxes can be super stressful. I know that I'm going to owe money, and so I'm avoiding all the emails from my accountant. I'm not alone. 88% of Americans reported financial stress at the start of 2026. So it's normal, but it doesn't mean you have to white-knuckle your way through. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. BetterHelp makes it easy, it says, by matching you with one of their over 30,000 licensed professionals tailored to your needs. And if it's not a perfect fit, you can switch at any time. And look, A therapist can't fix your money problems, but they can help you address shame, guilt, avoidance. Get matched with a qualified professional on BetterHelp. You can sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/radiolab. That's betterhelp.com/radiolab.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
Hey, we're back. So the first episode we ever podcasted, I don't know if it was literally the first, but it was among the first few, was an episode about time.
I do remember playing it to my wife, who I was always scared because she's a New York Times reporter, and I thought, oh, she'll never like this kind of thing. And she came out of the kitchen and she said, I really like that. And immediately I called
her. I remember you called me and you were like,
Damar likes it.
You were whispering, yeah, you're like, Damar likes it. Yeah, it was one of the early moments where like, maybe this will work. Again, this is something that fell off our podcast feed years ago, so probably very few people have heard this.
You're listening to Radio Lab. On New York Public Radio.
Public Radio,
WNYC.
You know this music. Trust me, you've heard it your entire life. The reason you can't recognize it now is because the composer, born in 1770, intended for this moment, the one you're hearing, to last 2 seconds. Like that. However, had he been a whale, Beethoven might have written his Ninth Symphony this way. Changes that, for us, would take an instant would transpire over minutes, and a movement might last 6 hours. That's in fact what this is. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony digitally stretched from its normal 60-some-odd minutes to last an entire day, 24 hours. And if you sit for the entire 24-hour duration of the piece, as people do from time to time, you realize that this music is not simply slower. The slowness unlocks something in the original. Maybe it was there all along and we couldn't hear it. We play with the meter, and music is mostly about meter after all, and the music has a different story to tell. A secret, perhaps. Locked up inside the routine, change the routine, you make new discoveries. That's what we'll do this hour. We'll look at time so closely, we'll discover new things about it. This is Radio Lab. I'm Jad Abumrad. My guest tonight for the next hour to help me wrestle with time is the science correspondent Robert Krulwich of ABC News, Nova, and Nightline. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. I like this bathing in Beethoven thing you've got going on.
It's cool,
here.
Right?
Nice.
Yeah. Actually, at the end of the program, we will be dropping in on a performance that happened recently in San Francisco where people listened to it over the course of an entire day.
A day.
So, where first?
Let's begin with a guy who I think you'll find, well, he thinks very deeply about time. In fact, in a very gentle kind of way, you could say he's time-obsessed. You've heard of the neurologist Oliver Sacks?
Sure. The man who mistook his wife for a hat.
Yeah, right.
And awakenings.
That's him. So I was over at his house. This is me actually over at his house right now.
Key turning.
And he told me this story.
I don't know whether this is relevant. I had an odd experience some years ago. In fact, in 1993, when I got a message from my publisher, which they had sent out to various of their authors for their 21st birthday, their jubilee, asking if we would like to select a year from the previous 21 years and write about it. When I got this message, I thought, well, why don't I choose 1972? Which was the first of the years, and it's a year which is very vivid and important for me partly because it was the year in which my mother died, partly it was the year in which I completed Awakenings. And these two events were coupled in some ways. I was actually in the car when I got this message. I picked it up on a car phone, and I was driving up to Canada, and I had a tape recorder with me. So I spoke 1972 aloud. And by that time, I thought, well, why stop? Why don't I do 1973 as well? By the time...
How long did 72 take? Did you get to Montreal, or were you still...
No, 72 probably took about half an hour. Well, by the time I got to the Canadian border, I was up to 1987. And I did, in fact, make an extra loop so that I could complete things. However, it turned out that the most recent years, in the late 80s and the 90s, I did not apparently have such detailed memories of, and they seem subjectively shorter.
So time, I guess we all know this, is a very plastic thing. It's right. Swollen and rich some of the time, and it's like flaccid and other times. But because Oliver is so inquisitive, such an investigator at heart, mm-hmm. all his life he's looked inside things. And beginning when he was 10, 11, 12, he wanted to get inside time.
I had lots of boyish interests, and these pre-adolescent interests, you know, they all took a beating when I became an adolescent. But one of them was chemicals, and I had a chemistry laboratory. One of them was photography, and I had darkroom and cameras. And one of them was plants. And in particular, my mother was very fond of ferns, and the garden was full of ferns. I love the way in which the curled-up fiddleheads or croziers of ferns would unfurl, and it was almost as if time was sort of rolled up inside them, as if time itself unfurled. But one couldn't actually see this. They would perhaps take a day or two to do this. And I wanted to see it. It made me think of these Christmas things one would blow in, these paper trumpets which would unfold. And so I set up my camera on a tripod, and at least in the daytime, I couldn't take pictures at night. I didn't have a flash then. I took a series of pictures every hour or so of the fern, and then showed these rapidly by putting them together in a flick book. And this way then, what took a day or two or several hours to happen was compressed into several seconds. So the compression of time photographically fascinated me.
Us too. If Oliver Sacks can make a baby fern unfurl, Robert, how about this? Radio producer Tony Schwartz can do the same thing with his baby niece.
What?
Except in sound.
Oh.
Here, sped up for your appreciation, is Nancy Schwartz from birth to age 12 in 2 minutes, 12 seconds exactly.
Jack and Jill went up the
hill
to fetch a pail of
water.
Jack fell down and broke
down.
And Jill came tumbling
after. Have a safe day. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. If you call the toy store up and you say, I want a puppy and a whistle and a horn and a hat and a dress and a ballerina costume, that's what you get. But when Santa Claus can't bring you, you can't cry. Tony, if the dog makes Willie a house, if you have to make him housebroken, if he makes Willie in the apartment, you have to slap him with a newspaper. Then if he doesn't do it again, he's housebroken.
What do you think of the Russians sending the dog up in the satellite?
Well, I hope he doesn't get hurt. But if he does, I'm sure they'll send up a medical satellite.
In school, we each had to do a report on someplace. And I'm doing a report on Hawaii. And we're taking notes and doing research.
This summer we're going camping, and in the month of July, this summer I'm going... For the whole month of July, this summer I'm going... to go to Brownie sleepaway camp. It's all girls. You'll mess my hair, and it's very special for tonight. It's just the way I want it. It's in a page boy with a high top, and that's the way I like it.
I'm taking guitar lessons, and that's fun. I take drama lessons after school, and that's great. And I've been working on the school newspaper. I might be editor next year. And I've been discovering boys.
You know what that is?
What's that?
That is, if you were a parent, what you've just heard is a parent clock.
Huh, a parent clock. That's kind of cool.
Because a kid gets older, you can't deny the fact that you must be getting older too. When your son has hair on his legs, I remember this. I thought, oh man, I'm getting old. But this is true. This is how the whole world works, I think.
It's everything is a clock, I guess.
Yeah.
By the way, that was Nancy Grows Up, an audio flipbook recorded and arranged by the great radio producer Tony Schwartz, thanks to him, and to Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, and also to you, Mr. Robert Krowich, for joining me today on our program to talk about time. So here's my question. If we've got an example of what you just called a parent clock, and you've got other kinds of time, you know, like personal time, getting out of bed time,
yeah,
going
to sleep
time.
Most of existence, really, time was measured by, oh, it's lunchtime, it's wake-up time, it's
right.
Time to milk the cow time, events or task
times. Tasks times. How do we get from task and personal time to clock time?
Ah, now that's interesting. Let's go back to the 1800s and imagine a guy, we'll call him, Zoltan Treboygan.
Zoltan Treboygan,
yes. Living in Sandusky, Ohio. And suppose Zoltan wants to know, you know, what time it is.
Okay.
So, if Zoltan walked into, say, Bigsby's Tavern and asked,
Mr. Bigsby, could I trouble you for the time? It's right in front of you. You see this clock here? It's built by my nephew, not the smartest boy in the world. It says 33 minutes past the hour. Is that right? Of course it's right.
However, if Zoltan, instead of going into the tavern, had he gone at the exact same moment into the bank building?
How can I help you, sir? Well, I wondered if you could show me the time. 3 minutes past the hour. Is it right, though? Yes, it's right.
Or, at that very same moment, suppose instead of going to the tavern or the bank, he'd gone to the hotel.
Can I help you? Could you tell me the time? Yes, of course. My timepiece here says...
Oh, is that silver?
Silver style, actually. It's 19 past the hour.
So at the tavern, it's 33 past the hour. At the hotel, 19 past. The bank, 3 past. What time is it really in Sandusky? That's the question. The answer is, there was no official time in Sandusky.
Huh? What do you mean there's no official time in Sandusky?
There wasn't any, not in 1850. The government didn't have a time.
Really?
All there were clocks. So in Ohio in the 1850s, you'd have as many times as there were clocks in the town.
Huh.
So there was no reason, when you think about it, to synchronize. If your clock and my clock were 4 minutes or 10 minutes different in Sandusky in the 1850s, who cares? Until the railroad changed everything. Once the railroad came in, if Zoltan wanted to take, I don't know...
How about the 303 to Cleveland?
Okay. If he wanted to take the 303 to Cleveland, how would he know when it was 303?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
If he went by the bank's clock, he'd arrive a half hour ahead of time. If he went by the hotel clock, he'd arrive in the nick of time.
Wait.
And if he went by the tavern's clock...
Oh, no! Wait!
So, for the sake of their business, really, railroads created railroad time and began putting up clocks of their own.
That makes sense.
And because the railroads were so important, I mean, the tavern would have to get its beer deliveries from the railroad.
And I guess the banks would have to get their cash from the railroad, and the hotel would have to get their guests from the railroad.
So, gradually, railroad time becomes everybody's time.
So, what happened to local time?
Well, local time disappeared.
Really?
Yeah, if local time means that when it's noon in Sandusky, the sun is directly over your head, by 1880, that wasn't true anymore.
Oh.
The railroad had instructed Sandusky that from now on, its noon would be 20 minutes later, so that it could fit into the railroad schedule.
Wait, so they moved noon over 20 minutes?
Yeah, and there were protests about this.
I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, who owns noon in Sandusky?
We do.
We have a railroad. Sandusky. 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 Railroad.
So in all seriousness, people fought against this? They rebelled against the railroads?
Oh, there were time wars in certain towns where part of the town would go to railroad time, but the other part would determinedly stick with what used to be local time, and they'd have different times in the town.
Wow. It's almost like it was a personal freedom issue.
Yeah, because time, in a way, represents your own identity, and they didn't want to give up their identity to the railroad, not at first. But in the end, Sandusky and then every other town eventually conformed to railroad time, and that is how time became standardized, time became zoned, time became clock reference. When you ask somebody, what time is it? They don't say, you know, oh, it's bedtime or it's lunchtime. They don't look up at the sun. They look at a clock, a standard clock, and the railroads did that.
Every tick of the clock is time won or lost. Every 60-minute sweep, every 12-hour tour of those relentless hands is turning out carload lots of time.
There's an interesting connection to explore here, and it has to do with horses.
Horses?
Horses. You mentioned railroad companies. It just so happens that the owner of the biggest railroad company, Leland Stanford, you know,
Stanford University.
Right. He was really into speed, and he owned a really fast horse, and the horse's name was Occident.
Occident. I remember that.
Story goes, this horse was the subject of a gentleman's bet.
Well, there was no gentleman's bet. It's a myth. Stanford, so far as we know, was not a betting man.
That's Rebecca Solnit. She would know. She wrote a book about this called River of Shadows. And the focus of her book is the solver of the bet, or whatever it was.
It was an argument. There's no evidence that there was money on it.
In any case, this argument amongst Stanford and his railroad buddies centered around the following question. When a horse gallops, do all four of its feet leave the ground at once? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's not a question I would frankly ever ask anyone, but...
Well, at the time, it was a big question, because they had no way of knowing, because horses moved faster than eyeballs could see.
So Leland Stanford wanted to prove that a horse had all 4 feet off the ground at one time, and he was recommended to try Muybridge as the photographer to capture this.
Along comes Edward Muybridge, the photographer. If he could take a picture of the horse at exactly the right instant, he could see whether all 4 feet were off the ground and solve the bet. Here's the problem. Cameras in those days were very slow.
A fast exposure would be maybe a second or several seconds. Muybridge was going to push photography to suddenly be able to capture motion in a 500th of a second. Otherwise, you just got blur.
Blur. Imagine that first step out of the world of the blur. Muybridge had stretched a wire across the racetrack and attached it to the shutter mechanism on his camera. Occident the horse gallops by, trips the wire, which freezes the horse mid-gallop, steals him right out of the flow of time. Except Muybridge doesn't just take one photo, he takes 24. See, he'd placed 24 cameras in a line, one after the other, with 24 trip wires stretching across the racetrack. And the horse tripped every one. Four frozen, unblurry, running horses.
So what did they see?
Well, the pictures formed a series of a horse running, and some of those photos showed Occident, yes, with all 4 feet off the ground.
So the camera here unlocks a secret. It lets us see something you could never see before, because this camera, essentially, it stops time.
Exactly. Meanwhile, says Rebecca, Muybridge became fascinated with learning more secrets of time. Secrets locked inside basic human movements.
A leap. A splash, a walk, a pirouette.
Wow, how mundane.
But they're so enchanted when you really pay attention to them.
Yeah.
Muybridge had photographed rushing water. He was obsessed with water in his landscape pictures. So he obsessively has people pour water, splash water, pour water over themselves, pour pitchers of water, pour water into glasses, splash water out of basins, bathe in water. And you can see all these droplets frozen in midair.
There's one particular photo, Robert, where you see a sheet of water suspended in the air, hovering over the splasher. Kind of like a ghost.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
Anyhow, take all those frozen moments and align them one after the other and play them back, and you've got flow again. Albeit artificial flow, which we call movies.
Movies are good.
Yeah, yeah. But... the next time you're feeling stressed out and you say to yourself, I'm stressed, I need to go to a movie to relax, well, you should know that the technology that made the movies is exactly the thing which sped up the pace of modern life, which stressed you out, which led you to go to the movies.
What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the first ways movies were used was to film factory workers doing repetitive tasks and then find out how to make those tasks more efficient.
So if I were pushing the lever maybe too slowly, is this how...
Right, they would find the guy who did it the right way, film him, slow the film down, and then use that to teach everyone else.
And then when World War II came, this was not just now in the cause of efficiency. This was a life or death matter, because this is how you beat Nazis.
All the scientific devices of chronology are machines manufacturing time. The tool that in our hands means victory. And our hands must be as relentless as the hands of our clock.
Or there's a whole nother way to think about this. Time can be a weapon in battle, mm-hmm. or it can be the most sensuous and subtle and natural thing in the world. And I learned about this from a book by Jay Griffiths called A Sideways Look at Time. Let me just take a stop here at the clocks, even though you don't like clocks, because there's so many cool clocks in your book.
Cool clocks.
First of all, there's a spice clock.
Yes. We're used to clocks which you can see when it's really dark and it's, you know, and you can see that you've just woken up at 2:35 and you really didn't want to wake up at 2:35. But of course, for a long time, you know, in the night, you don't have a way of seeing what the time is. And so somebody invented a spice clock so you could taste your way through the night. So there would be maybe kind of, you know, cinnamon for about 1 o'clock and turmeric for 2 o'clock.
So you're sitting there in bed and you sniff the time.
Well, you could taste it.
Right, how about the clock of birds? This is the Kaluli people.
Oh, yes. Now, this is lovely. The Kaluli people of Papua New Guinea, they have what they call a clock of birds, and that certain birds, like the New Guinea friar bird and the hooded butcher bird, when they sing in the mornings, the children are taught to understand that that's a signal to get up and leave and, you know, get out of the house. When those birds sing their late afternoon calls, that's a signal to the children to go back home. The forest in the Central Highlands in Papua New Guinea, I've been there, it's a very, very difficult place to be in once it's dark, and that children would need to know at what time to start heading for home.
Now how about it's 1751... and Carl Linnaeus, famous categorizer of everything,
yes, made
in Sweden.
A flower clock.
What did he make?
A flower clock, so that you could see by the blooming of different flowers what time it was.
Some kind of something that blooms in the morning and then
yes.
folds up like a morning glory would be there in the morning, and
yes.
then in the evening, an evening primrose would
yes.
come out.
Yes.
But these are all plants that open for an hour or two and then close. So if you're walking by.
Mm.
And you see a blush of, let's say, pink, then you know, oh, it must be the morning. Or if you see a blush of purple, you know, oh, it must be lunchtime, or
yes.
whatever it is.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
That's, by the way, very, very good gardening to be able to do that.
Yes, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't it? And connected to that, there's also in the Andaman forests and the Andaman Islands in the Indian Ocean that people have a scent calendar, which I found the most beautiful idea, because what it was is a way of kind of describing the months by the scents of certain fruits and flowers. Time is everywhere in nature. One of the things I wanted to do with the whole book was to say, you know, we think of time being to do with clocks. In fact, for most of the world, for most of history, time has been absolutely embedded in nature in some beautiful ways.
Thanks, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Jad Abumrad. Robert Krubwich and I will be back in a moment.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
On New York Public Radio.
Public Radio, WNYC.
So that was a chunk of the first thing we ever podcast. It was a show about time. And it's in honor of our 15th birthday. Because it's funny, Robert. Like we just looked at our RSS feed recently.
SS is
It's a, I don't know what it stands for. It's the thing that like feeds iTunes. Mm-hmm. So when you go on iTunes and you see all the episodes, you sort of see what's there. And there's some limit that iTunes places on the number of items that you can have in the feed.
Oh.
And there, I think it's like 100 or 150 or something. And we realized like 150 early episodes have fallen off the feed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So like, if we were a backlist like at Random House, that would mean like Hemingway and Fitzgerald have fallen onto the floor. Somewhere.
Exactly. So like this huge number of old episodes have fallen off. Mm. And I started looking at that list. And on that list are some episodes that are weirdly relevant now. And a whole bunch that are just completely not relevant. And I was like, I think I want to pull some of those back into the flow.
Yeah, I do.
And because it'll give us a chance to like sort of just reframe them and really think about them and update them. And sometimes the science gets old and needs to be updated, but sometimes
the science gets refreshed by something that's happening in the real world.
So yeah.
Something, it gets on a certain urgency. Yeah, so what the plan would be is maybe – you know, in the coming months, we would go way back for us, which is like 14, 13, 15, 12 years back, and resurrect things and throw them out and see who wants to take a smack at them now and whether there's things have changed.
Yeah.
And whether they're more interesting or utterly wrong now.
Yeah, or wrong in a fascinating way.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. That's the advantage of getting old is you can...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
You can play with your memories.
Exactly.
And not be a rabbit. Well, there you go.
All right. Well, that was something. I'm Jan Abumrad.
Yeah, I'm Robert Grolwich.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah. We'll be normal next time.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Liza, and it would be unlike me to pass up a staff credit. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Soren Wheeler is senior editor. Jamie York is our senior producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, David Gable, Tracy Hunt, Matt Kielty, Robert Krawich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Arian Wack, and Molly Webster, with help from Valentina Bohanini, Nagar Fatali, Phoebe Wang, and Katie Ferguson. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.